bringing you the latest in tax credit news, insight, and analysis. This is Tax Credit Tuesday with your host, Michael Novogradic.
Hello, I'm Michael Novogradic, and this is Tax Credit Tuesday. This is the June 4th, 2024 podcast. Election Day is November 5th of this year. That's a mere 5 months from today. Although voting even starts much earlier than that in many states, as early as late September in a few. As you've no doubt heard many times, this is a consequential election in many ways. Today, we're going to discuss the implications for various community development tax incentives. Now, as our viewers on YouTube can see, I'm pleased to have Peter Lawrence as my guest this week. Peter is Novogradic Director of Public Policy and Government Relations. Peter is here today to discuss how the election results might affect community development tax incentives. Now, by community development tax incentives, I mean the low-income housing tax credit, the new markets tax credit, the historic rehabilitation tax credit, opportunity zones, and also clean energy tax credits. Advocates for these tax incentives are particularly interested in the election results because many individual and business tax provisions are scheduled to expire at the end of 2023. Most of those expirations are of tax changes enacted as part of 2017 Trump tax legislation. But we have reference, the Congressional Budget Office recently estimated that the cost of extending the expiring Trump tax provisions was approximately $4.6 trillion. That's trillion with the T. Their looming expiration means the next president and Congress will almost undoubtedly pass major tax legislation sometime during 2025 or in 2026, but nearly certainly before the end of 2026. Now, I mentioned passing in 2026, even though the provisions expired in 2025, because Congress has often extended tax provisions retroactively, that is, after the provisions have expired. And in some ways, the real key date would be before individuals and businesses are filing the tax returns for 2026, which is early 2027, but I don't want to go out that far. I want to think end of 2025, early 2026. Now, according to the Tax Foundation, if Congress doesn't pass a tax bill before tax returns are filed for 2026, then taxes would go up for 62% of Americans. This obviously means which party controls the presidency, which party controls the two chambers of Congress are critical issues. And that's what Peter and I will discuss today. My column in the June issue of the Novogradic Journal of Tax Credits addresses this issue, and I will provide a link to it in today's show notes. But suffice it to say, there are many possible outcomes. 5 months before Election Day, it remains very unclear who will control the White House, the Senate, or the House of Representatives. And I have no doubt that lack of clarity will carry us all the way through election. Today, Peter and I will discuss why this election is so crucial to community development stakeholders. We'll examine the state of the different races. And most importantly, we'll discuss what might we should expect under various election outcomes. Now, I emphasize what we might expect because we don't know for sure what will happen, of course, as there's not only a variety of possible outcomes as to which party controls the House, the Senate, and the presidency, but the margin of control in the House will also play a critical role. And there's going to be a lot of items playing a critical role that haven't happened yet that we don't know, the unknown unknowns. Now, Peter knows as much about this as anyone, and we have a lot to discuss. So if you're ready, let's get started. Peter, welcome back to Tax Credit Tuesday. As our most frequent guest, if you're not counting, today is your 16th appearance on the podcast. You're our most frequent guest, and Tony Grapponi, though, is two podcasts behind you.
Well, thank you, Mike. I don't take it for granted, and it's a testament to your focus on policy issues why this podcast has featured me. So thank you for your interest in policy.
Well, thank you. And before we dive into today's topic, want you to share with our listener some of the services you provide to Novogradic clients.
Yeah, so we, of course, operate through various working groups, including the low-income housing tax credit working group, the new markets, Tax Credit Working Group, the Opportunity Zones Working Group, and the Renewable Energy Working Group. And each of those are organized by clients and stakeholders who care very much with each of those tax incentives. And through those working groups, we advocate for consensus solutions, both in legislation and regulations. And we will, of course, often talk to the key federal agencies that oversee the tax incentives, as well as members of Congress. And clients can also engage us to do various policy-focused research and other advocacy engagements. So I look forward to working with any of you.
Now, as I said earlier, this election is especially significant to those involved in affordable housing development because of the tax legislation piece and the fact that the cost of the tax legislation will be so substantial. And in the course of this podcast, we're going to talk about pay-fors. That we maybe will have a future podcast where we start to think about pay-fors and the rest, but that's a little bit premature until we know who controls the House, the Senate, and the presidency. But maybe you could expand a little bit more for our listeners on the significance of this election and this large tax legislation that we're anticipating in 2025 or 2026.
Yes. Well, so there have been a number of provisions, high profile provisions from the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017, otherwise known as the Trump Tax Cut Bill, many of the individual tax provisions are expiring, and even some of the corporate tax provisions are also expiring or have recently expired, maybe not necessarily in 2025, but in recent years. And given the confluence of all these expirations, that's leading Congress to really put a lot of attention and prepare as much as possible addressing whether to extend them, how to extend them, whether to pay for them or whether not to pay for them. And get, as you mentioned, $4.6 trillion is a pretty significant amount of money, even in federal terms. To give you a comparison, when the Joint Committee on Taxation evaluated the Trump tax cut law in 2017, they estimated that the legislation would cost $1.5 trillion over 10 years. Well, just to extend the provisions that expire in 2025, as you mentioned earlier, it's gone up to $4.6 trillion. So it really underscores how significant a moment this is for tax policy and how motivated members of Congress will be. As you mentioned, some things can trip up process and take longer than anticipated. But I do think that fact, according to the Tax Foundation, 62% taxpayers would have their taxes go up if Congress did not act at all on these expirations is a pretty strong motivating force.
I would note that President Biden also has said that those who would have a tax increase that have incomes of under $400,000, those would be extended. So it's not as if President Biden has said he wouldn't extend them. He just has said they wouldn't extend them in their entirety. And it would obviously take a different shape, which we'll talk about more in a moment, depending upon who wins the presidency. I would also note that just for a point of reference, the New Market Tax Credit's last round is in 2025. So the New Market Tax Credit will technically expire at the end of next year. And the Opportunity Zones incentive has a big deadline in 2026. So that both of those incentives are particularly focused on this next big tax bill. And then obviously there's a number of Horizon Credit Improvement Act and other provisions we'll talk about more in a moment. Now, I noted in my introduction that tax legislation won't necessarily be passed and enacted in 2025. Because as we've seen, these negotiations take time, and it's possible that Congress won't finalize tax legislation until 2026. So I want to discuss with you the various permutations of the election results in terms of control of the presidency, the House, and the Senate. But before we do that, I thought it would be useful just to look at the race for the White House, the race for the control of the Senate, race for the control of the House. So let's start with the race for the control of the White House. You know, very briefly, share with our listeners where the race for the White House currently stands.
Well, despite the fact that former President Trump was convicted in a state case in New York last week, the race is extraordinarily close, and it appears likely to stay very close in these last 5 months we have. It really comes down to six or seven states where this race will be determined. And those states are Arizona, Nevada, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Georgia, and to some extent even North Carolina. And those states are likely to swing the election one way or the other. And it could be decided by, the total votes might be as amount as many people you could fit in a football stadium. And when you think of the country as a whole with, 335 million people and roughly half of those registered voters, that's, quite a small margin in the grand scheme of things. And each of those states, many of them, currently has a polling lead, although it's still fairly early in the election season. And not every single voter is engaged. But each of those seven states are likely to be very close. And all it will take is a slight shift one way or another one candidate or the other to win. So definitely, keep an eye out. I think there's going to be very much a nail-biting race from my perspective.
No, I totally agree with you. And I feel like there's particular attention in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania for Biden, and for Trump to be focused on Arizona, Nevada, Georgia, North Carolina, and then winning either Wisconsin, Michigan, or Pennsylvania. And I would also note, as you and I have discussed before, Peter, that Nebraska and Maine also will give an electoral vote for winning a congressional district. And while Nebraska statewide is expected to go for Trump, Biden would get one, it's anticipated to get one electoral vote. And for Maine, it's the opposite. And if those one votes ended up switching, it could end up being the difference in having a victor and having a tied presidential election.
Yeah, indeed. In fact, if Biden were to win Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, and that second district in Nebraska where Omaha is based,
right,
I'll give him 270 electoral votes, the minimum you need.
Yep. But he also has to win. That's right. He has to win the one in Nebraska, where if he didn't get the one in Nebraska, he'd be tied.
Indeed.
So let's turn to the Senate now. Most prognosticators think the Senate will go Republican. Maybe explain that for our listeners.
Yes, indeed. Every 3 years, there's a different Senate map because not all senators are up for re-election. They have 6-year terms. And so you've got, just by the fate of the map, every election year, a different set of senators are up for election. And this year, in 2024, the map is decidedly in favor of Republicans. There are many more Democrats running for, and then, of course, the various senators that are registered independent but caucus with the Democrats. Those seats are up this cycle, and there are comparatively fewer Republican incumbents. all of those Republican incumbents are in states that Trump won in 2020. And there are three Senate seats up currently held by Democrats, or I suppose I should say, actually, yes, this past weekend.
Yes, two Democrats in
that. They actually decided to register as independents. So actually, I guess now four independent senators instead of three. And two of them are, seats are up. Both of them have currently at least expressed that they are not running for re-election. So we assume there remain open seats. And in particular, that Senate seat held by Joe Manchin in West Virginia, you know, if the senator does not run, as we currently expect, it is highly, highly likely that the Republicans will flip that seat, giving them essentially, you know, a map where they're at essentially 50-50 right now, as we speak. That means if Trump wins, then they have the majority in the Senate because the vice president breaks the tie. And again, assuming all the various Republicans senators are reelected, if they flip one Democratic seat beyond that, even if Biden is reelected, they have control of the Senate. And they have multiple opportunities to do that. You know, beyond Manchin, there's also Tester in Montana and Senator Sherrod Brown in Ohio, both states that Trump won. You know, in Ohio, he won by 8 percentage points. In Montana, he won by 15. And so that sort of really demonstrates that both Tester and Brown have to considerably outperform Biden in order to be reelected. Certainly possible. And they both of which have been through tough elections before and know how to campaign, but it's a tall order to do so. So it's not surprising to think that Republicans have the inside track. You know, there are also a number of other races with Democratic incumbents or open Democratic seats where they're going to be close and then challenging. Like, you know, there's an open seat in Arizona, open seat in Maryland, open seat in Michigan. There's the race in Nevada, the races in Pennsylvania, and races in Wisconsin, all of which, by the way, are those states that are going to be contested in the presidential election. So one could imagine that, you know, depending on which president wins, that will help, their respective Senate candidates win that race as well. Even though I will note that it does seem like all the Democratic incumbents currently are outperforming Biden in the polling, which, you know, they're going to, and as I mentioned, the case of Tester and Brown, they have to do it to a big degree. In general, just to, you know, recap, Republicans are definitely favored by most political pundits to take control of the Senate after the election.
And I've seen as there's like 60 or 70% chance favoring the Republicans. And I will observe that I don't think I've ever seen an incumbent retiring and the initial estimate in terms of who's going to win that race switch to the other party into the safe calls. Most prognosticators have the West Virginia Manchin seat as safe Republican. So it is quite remarkable. And as you point out, technically, as of this weekend, he's an independent, not a Democrat. Let's talk about the House briefly. So how's the House looking in terms of the Republicans taking over control, or the Democrats, or the Republicans keeping control, or the Democrats taking over control?
So I think that, first of all, it's worth just reminding folks how it's very close right now. There are 218 Republican senators, or sorry, Republican members of the House of Representatives, and 213 Democrats, and some vacancies. At the beginning of this Congress, it was 222 Republicans to 213 Democrats. One of the most narrow margins of control of any Congress in recent history. At least the initial polling suggests that it'll be very close as well in November. And it could be that the Republicans retain control. Again, I would say if Trump wins, then the chances of Republicans maintaining control of the House go up. If Biden wins, the chances of Democrats flipping control also go up. There's not as much split-ticking voting as there used to be in the past. So you definitely see a lot of these voting patterns becoming more nationalized. I will note that there are also more Republicans running in districts that Biden won than House Democrats running in districts that Trump won. So that's a bit of a structural advantage Democrats have. But there were also predictions that the redistricting was expected to happen for this election didn't turn out to be as dramatic as some people thought it might be. It's more of a wash than of an advantage for one party or the other. I've seen predictions all over the board on this. I think it's going to be relatively close. And I don't think that either party is going to have commanding advantage. With a narrow control, you may see challenges in managing the House. This is what we've seen in this current Congress, where getting 218 votes on any piece of legislation can be a challenge. Margin of victory is going to be really important on tax incentives.
I would just note, Peter, you and I have talked a lot about there's a sort of a betting market called Poly Market, and it actually has bets on whether or not there'll be a Republican sweep, a Democratic sweep, or some version of mixed control. And I would just note for our listeners, Poly Market has chance of a Republican sweep in the high 30s and the chances of a Democratic sweep in the low 20s, which means the chance of mixed government in the high 30s as well. So, Peter, based on the closeness of the races, they're not even just based on the closeness of the races, just theoretically, in an election like this, there's, generally speaking, 8 possible scenarios. You can think of the White House, either it's going to go Republican or Democratic. And then the same thing for the House and the Senate. And simple math, take 2, raise it to the third power, it says there's 8 possible permutations. But they're not all as equally likely, of course. And when I think of the possible scenarios, I break them quickly down into 3, like I just sort of mentioned: a Republican sweep, a Democratic sweep, or some form of divided government. So I thought it'd be useful now to talk about each of those 3 scenarios: one of the 2 sweep scenarios or the divided government. And when I think of the 2 sweep scenarios, as you and I have discussed in the past, that the general consensus under either sweep scenario is that a tax bill would be enacted via the reconciliation process. And this means that the party in control would enact a strictly partisan bill. So if you have a Republican sweep of the White House, we would be expecting a partisan Republican bill, much like the Trump tax cuts. And if the Democrats were to sweep the White House, Senate, and House, then we would expect a partisan Democratic bill, just like we had with the Inflation Reduction Act. So let's start with the Republican sweep of the White House, Senate, and House. If you could share, Peter, your broad thoughts as the impact that has on community tax legislation.
Absolutely. And while definitely in broad strokes, we would definitely see, I think, similar policy preferences to the Trump tax cut law. And there are a couple of different key differences I want to just point out for listeners. One, given that tax bills, including reconciliation bills, need to originate the House Ways and Means Committee chairman is key here. And we have one big difference from 2017, and that is Jason Smith is most likely going to be the Ways and Means Committee chairman next year, just as he is right now, in a Republican control context. And he's a very different chairman than Kevin Brady, who was the former Republican Ways and Means chairman back in 2017. He's speaking at our upcoming New Markets Conference, by the way, and this week. And he has a history of strong support for community development tax incentives. And so right from the start, he's an ally of what the community development tax credits do. And so he's not likely in and of himself have a bias against them. And so I think that's one key thing I would want to make sure everyone realizes. That being said, being in a reconciliation a scenario, it's likely they're going to press for partisan tax proposals. And, one of the challenges we have, the three development role in that context, is that our incentives are bipartisan. And there is often this feeling amongst leadership to say, well, we can deal with the bipartisan issues later. We've got this once in a generation opportunity to do reconciliation, maybe once every 10 years, maybe a generation a little bit too extreme. And we need to take advantage of this once a decade opportunity to put our preferences in now, because who knows when we'll have this opportunity. What this really means, though, in terms of the various tax incentives, I will say in general, it's a little bit more defensive, especially for low-income housing tax credit, new markets tax credit, historic credits, and probably most notably with the renewable energy credits. I will just sort of point out that when a House flipped to Republican control for this Congress, and they were considering debt limit legislation, at one stage, they did propose repealing many of the energy tax incentive provisions from the Inflation Reduction Act. And one could imagine that those could be a pay for. I know, Mike, you didn't want to bring up pay fors, but I do think that's something that is the renewable energy community needs to be prepared and aware of.
Totally agree with that. So when I certainly did want to discuss pay fors more broadly, but it's easy to see how some portion of the Inflation Reduction Act gets repealed to help lower the cost of a general sort of a tax extension bill under a Republican sweep scenario.
Indeed, indeed. But on the flip side, I will say there are a number of initiatives under the community development umbrella that may have a better chance to advance. And I'm thinking here of provisions that target rural America. We know that Chairman Smith has wanted to prioritize provisions targeting rural America. And so, there are several in the community development space. There's the Rural Opportunity Zone program that he actually did advance in legislation last year. And I would imagine might be brought back next year. There's the Rural Jobs Act, which would set aside a $500 million per year for new markets allocations targeting rural America, especially persistently poor and high migration counties. There's the Rural Basis Boost for the low-income housing tax credit, and even a permanent 30% historic tax credit for small properties, which tend to be in rural America. So definitely there's some, offensive and defensive opportunities in a Republican sweep scenario.
And I would note that when we talk about reconciliation legislation, I would remind everyone that when you when you pass reconciliation legislation, the bill has to be revenue neutral in the out years after year 10. So you can run up the deficit for 10 years, but you can't have it be revenue neutral in the out years, which means if we do end up in one of these sweep scenarios, I can right now plan 8 years or so from now. I know what Peter and I might be talking about in a podcast, because we'd have all of this, would be basically kicking the can down the road, which I will also note that I think there is generally an expectation when this tax bill is discussed and enacted in 2025 or 2026, that it would likely be over an 8-year, 10-year period under the two sweep scenarios. If we go into a non-sweep scenario, then it's easier to see how whatever legislation passed isn't the full 10 years. But if it's under reconciliation, either party will think, this is my chance to do something for the next 10 years, and I want to make it longer, not shorter. Whereas in a bipartisan negotiation, you can oftentimes see shorter-termed, shorter-lived legislation and matters like these.
Yeah, and Mike, if I could also mention that, I do think Republican sweep scenario, that the chances of getting not just a simple extension of the opportunity zone, but some sort of more robust enhancement goes up, given that it is a big priority of Senator Tim Scott, who may have a bigger role to play in next year, depending on the election and what happens. And we know that opportunity zones was very much lauded at a recent hearing. The Ways and Means Committee's got lots of support. And so I think that there's an even bigger offensive opportunity there for the opportunity zone incentive.
You know, and you mentioned earlier several times how the margin of the majority just is important. I did want to remind our audience that in 2021, when the Democratic Party controlled the presidency and both chambers of Congress, the Senate Democrats could not reach agreement. Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Christian Sinema of Arizona were two of the more challenging members of the Senate, that they couldn't get to full agreement with their caucus. And as a result, President Biden could not enact his Build Back Better plan. Obviously, he was successful with the Inflation Reduction Act later. That was an example where the majority was so narrow, it was very challenging to enact single-party legislation. So I wanted to turn to the other sweep scenario, where President Biden is reelected and he brings along a Democratic Senate and House. So share your thoughts on community development, tax legislation in that scenario.
Well, yeah, as you mentioned, Mike, Build Back Better legislation did, start, 3 years ago. And I imagine that a lot of those proposals that you saw on that legislation in the early stages will get a second chance. And again, depending on the margin, of course, as I said, I think the Republicans are very much favored in the Senate. So it's not, I think, terribly inconceivable that in a Democratic sweep scenario, the most likely sweep scenario you see there is a 50-50 split with, a vice president. Right. And that means just one Democratic senator, maybe, the newly reelected, Senator Tester and Brown, who just realized how close their election was and maybe worried straying too far away, or other, moderate Democratic senators would replay the role that Senators Manchin and Sinema played. So I don't think it's likely to be a hugely expansive opportunity. But we do know that there's also a lot of pent-up desire among Democrats in Congress to advance proposals. And, that I imagine, a lot of the community dollar tax incentives would sort of like get a serious look at a, you know, Democratic reconciliation bill. There's the Affordable Housing Credit Improvement Act has many, many provisions, and there's a lot strong, strong support amongst Democrats in Congress for it, as well as Republicans. But I do know that's something that they're likely to push for, and maybe perhaps a few other opportunities as well, like the neighborhood homes tax credit proposal to, you know, based on to a large part low-income housing tax credit, but to build, you know, owner-occupied housing in distressed communities, you know, starter homes. Workforce housing credit may get a second look, you know, to build housing for renters that are earning just above the traditional low-income housing tax credit limits. There's, of course, we mentioned new markets. You can imagine the new markets getting pretty robust, you know, set of proposals, including permits. And historic tax credit is something that, you know, Richie Neal, when he was chairman, put in a robust set of proposals based on the Historic Tax Credit Growth and Opportunity Act. And I, you know, if he were to regain the chairmanship in a House Democratic sweep, then I wouldn't be surprised to see those proposals back in there. You know, opportunity zones, of course, on the flip side, maybe, is perhaps a more challenging path. It is bipartisan, but it does have a little bit of a Republican perceived prioritization. And so I do wonder what the chances are in the Democratic sweep scenario for opportunity zones, but we'll just have to see, I guess.
And I would note that the estimate of the 4.6, 4.7 trillion, the Democrats do sweep, then that cost estimate comes down, you know, dramatically, given President Biden saying, you know, extended those that for those who are under 400,000 of income, but, you know, not above that. And also President Biden has discussed raising the corporate tax rate, which would raise more revenue to help offset that. So the math is definitely notably different under a Democratic sweep in terms of the big picture dollar items. So Peter, we've talked about a Republican sweep and a Democratic sweep, which I will remind our audience that is what happened the past two presidential elections. In 2016, the Republicans swept the White House and both chambers of Congress, and in 2020, the Democrats did the same. So that is, if you just went back to the sample size of the last two elections, I think that was a given that's going to happen. But as we also noted earlier, there is a greater than the betting markets say there's a high 30%, in the high 30s is the chance that we'll have a split government. So Peter, if you could share your thoughts as to what a split government means. That means, you know, between the presidency, the House and the Senate, there's two Democratic control parts or two Republican control parts and one Democrat, at least one Democrat, and at least one Republican control part. What you think we should expect split government outcome?
Yeah. And I'll just also note, you know, Michael, to riff a little bit on your point here, the first 2 years of Obama's presidency was full Democratic control. The first 2 years of George W. Bush's presidency was full Republican control. The first 2 years of Clinton's presidency was full Democratic control. So it does seem like, with respect to our first 2 years,
right,
there's a decent chance of you know, see, at least when you look at those scenarios. I still will say, coming from my perspective now, given that Senate, to me, I still think a split government seems to be, pretty probable in my mind. whatever, even the poly market may not necessarily agree at this moment. And I do think that does have one sort of key piece of this is that it makes reconciliation less likely. I mean, it is certainly possible. Let's say you have a Biden presidency and a Republican House and Senate. Yeah, you could still imagine reconciliation being pursued as a sort of a tactical matter because the Republicans will want to have as partisan a piece of legislation to negotiate with President Biden. But if you have a split between, you know, House and Senate control, the chance of reconciliation go down considerably to near zero because I can't imagine them agreeing on a joint budget resolution together. You just have not seen that at all. I can't remember if it's ever happened. Maybe that's something that one could research later, but I think it's we sort of start off with this idea that it's a challenging bipartisan negotiation, it really becomes. You do certainly have perhaps a more stable, a more permanent tax policy because whatever is negotiated may be done so on a longer term basis. I think it, given that there are different priorities amongst the parties and it's such a huge challenge on how to address that cost, it will be a challenging negotiation, but I still do think that there will be, some sort of legislation in the end because, that the compelling point about how, as many as 62% of Americans would get a tax increase if they don't act, they sort of swipe and snipe at each other and try to blame each other. It's not going to work because the American public will say you're an inaction led to me to have a tax increase. So I do think that there will be a tax bill, but it will look very different from the two partisan sweepstakes.
And I would just add to that, this has happened before. Bush, George W. Bush tax cuts passed under reconciliation expired 8 years later. Barack Obama was president, and they ended up, and it was divided government, and by one calculation, 98% of the tax cuts were extended. And I am not suggesting that under a divided government, 98% of the Trump tax cuts would be extended, but some large portion of them would be. The question would just be what portion and getting paid for or not. So, I mentioned earlier, negotiations could continue into 2026. Recent years have shown it's very difficult to predict, not only what will happen, but the timing as well. We at Novogratz will continue to keep an eye on it as we get close to the election. And then obviously after the election, we'll be spending even more time on it. And we'll definitely be spending more time in due course on some of the pay for outcomes. So as you start to think about how much debt might be the Congress being willing to increase versus how much they might be willing to adjust other provisions to raise revenue. And as I also mentioned earlier,
to interrupt you, but yes. They need to raise the debt limit again early next year. Well, at least the suspension will expire early next year. But and at some point of the year, they're going to Congress. That's going to be a very challenging exercise and a split government. So that's something for.
And then also, as I said earlier, my column in this month's Novogratz Journal of Tax Credits is about the election results, what they could mean. I'll share a link to it in today's show notes. I encourage you to take a read. If you have any thoughts you wanted to add, just tweet out those thoughts to me. My Twitter handle or my X handle is at Novogratic. Peter, before we move on, is there anything else that listeners and viewers should be aware of?
So I want to just once again remind listeners that we do have our New Markets Tax Credit Conference in DC this week. It's not too late to register and attend. We have Chairman Jason Smith keynoting. He's going to be talking to you, Mike. And a lot of these questions we'll be discussing, and you'll be able to hear from one of the very key tax policymakers on this very issue. So it's definitely want to encourage you to attend. And I will note that, as we always do, all the Novogratic working groups will continue to be engaged with the key federal agencies in Congress. And we'll, as part of that work, we'll be also previewing the election and then, of course, debriefing what it all means. So if you're not a member of any of our working groups, please reach out. You can join. I'm sure you'll put links to that in the show notes, Mike. So encourage folks to investigate. If you have any questions about work groups, please feel free to reach out to me.
Excellent. Thank you, Peter. And yes, I will include the links to the conference and the working groups in the show notes for today's episode. And I will also include Peter's contact information. And before we get to the off-mic section, I'd like to remind our listeners and viewers to subscribe to our podcast on whatever platform you prefer. And I also encourage you to share the podcast with your colleagues who might be interested. And also, I'd ask you, personal request, if you're enjoying the podcast, please take a moment to review the podcast on your platform of choice. So, Peter, now we're in our off-mic section, and we've been using this section as an opportunity to offer a shout-out to someone working in community development. So, Peter, you work in a variety of fields, though we do have our New Market Tax Credit Conference coming this week. Who would you like to give a shout-out to today?
Yeah, well, I you know, I'm always loath to favor one of the tag incentives over the other. They're all important, and we work with a variety of stakeholders in each of those. But given that it is week of our New Markets Tax Credit Conference, and that they will be joining you for the ever popular Watch the Report panel, I do feel I want to do a shout out to two main advocacy experts on the New Markets Tax Credit, Bob Raposa of the New Markets Tax Credit Coalition, and Jeff McMillan of the Partnership for Job Creation, two really fantastic advocates for the New Markets. Key ones, if you're a stakeholder in the New Markets Tax Credit, you should join one or both of those organizations because they're doing extremely important work to, first of all, make New Markets Tax Credit permanent. And make sure it works as best as possible to deliver private capital to low-income communities across the country. So please join me in recognizing the great efforts of Bob and Jeff.
Great. Thank you for that, Peter. And I'll echo your shout-out for Bob Raposa and Jeff McMillan. It's been great working with them over the years and look forward to working with them into the future. And we all owe both of them a great debt, all of us who work in community development, for the advocacy work that they've done on behalf of such a critical revitalizing tool at the New Market Tax Credit. And thank you, Peter, for all your advocacy work on behalf of community development tax incentives. And thank you for joining me here today. And to our listeners, I'm Mike Novogratic. Thanks for listening.
This weekly podcast has been brought to you by Novogratic & Company, LLP. Archived podcasts are available online at www.novoco.com/podcast or by subscribing to the Tax Credit Tuesday podcast in iTunes, Spotify, YouTube, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, and Radio Public. You can find related links referenced in this podcast on our website at www.novoco.com/podcast. Novogratic & Company, LLP is a national certified public accounting and consulting firm with offices nationwide. Learn more about our professional services at www.novoco.com.